So hello and welcome to this week's instalment of Nucleus Investment Insights. And today we're having a look at the house crash and whether it's going to smash the Australian economy. Really looking forward to today's one. I think 2019 is going to certainly shape the investment landscape and obviously our economic landscape as well. And it's good that we're joined today, first time this year, by our chief economist, Leith Van Onselen. G'day, Leith.
G'day, Tim. G'day, everyone.
And our chief strategist, David Llewellyn-Smith, is back again.
Hello.
Hi, David. And finally, head of investments, Damien Klassen. G'day, Damien. So we're jumping into the content for today. So we're going to be looking at the four pillars of the Australian economy. G'day, Damien.
Hey, Tim.
There we go. We're going to be looking at dwelling construction, household consumption, public demand, and some stats on business investment as well. And as always, we'll be folding all these up and putting them into place for implications for investment on how we do things in the portfolios every day at Nucleus Wealth and the MB Fund. So with no further ado, I will kick us off with real final demand, a terrific looking chart that we've got up here. Leith, would you like to walk us through the Australian real final demand chart here?
Yeah, okay. Now, this chart comes from the Australian ABS, and what it basically shows is the breakdown of what drives real final demand across the Australian economy. Now, real final demand is basically GDP without net exports, so it shows the actual demand within the economy without leakages overseas, with exports minus imports. And what it basically shows is that the Australian economy is broken down into four main drivers of growth. First and foremost, we've got household consumption, which as at September 2018 comprised 57% of final demand, so it's the primary driver. There's also dwelling investment, which is 6% share. Public demand, which is obviously public consumption spending on things like health programs, etc., and infrastructure, that's 24% share. And finally, we've got business investment, which is things like capital expenditure, etc., and that's a 13% share. And what it basically shows is that that final demand was running over 3% as at the September 28 quarter, which is a pretty decent level. But however, we think that over the next year, because of falls in consumption spending, dwelling investment, and public demand peaking, that we're actually looking at quite a sharp slowdown over the next 12 months, with it more likely to fall, probably below 2%.
Okay, sure. And so you've obviously got, we've got the UR here arrow there, and then those predictions that you've sort of put in place sort of for the next few quarters.
Yeah. Now these Dave did for the annual report, the annual Christmas report, which came out in December. And if anything, it's probably weakened further from what we thought back then. But it's just sort of there as a bit of a pro forma to give you an idea.
Okay. All right. Fantastic. Any points to note on this chart while we're here, gents?
Yeah. Just as Lee says, that the black line is your actual growth line for domestic demand. And if we redid that today, that fall off would be steeper.
Okay.
As Lee hinted at, simply because the flow of data over the last 6 weeks has been dire.
Okay, yeah, sure.
And the Australian economy is slowing very fast, faster than we expected even.
Okay, yep, and certainly a theme for, I think, the rest of today's webinar. We'll jump across into dwelling construction, so the first of the four pillars of Australian demand.
And yep. Actually, that's house price growth. It's been
labeled.
So
volumes over and price and growth. Yep.
Yeah. So what we're looking at first is actually household consumption. So what I've got there is because household consumption is the biggest, that's 57%. Its primary driver in the next year is probably going to be the Australian housing market, and as we know, the Australian housing market's falling at an incredibly strong pace. It's down about 9% year on year, and the quarterly falls are running about 3.5%. Which is incredibly fast, about 14% year on year. On top of that, we've also got a huge decline in actual dwelling sales. Those have crashed by more than a third from peak. So we're looking at a massive fall in both prices prices as well as sales. And the reason why this is important is because of the wealth effect. Now, generally speaking, when dwelling prices rise, consumers feel more confident. They draw down their savings. They spend more. You know, JB Hi-Fi, Harvey Norman, etc. The empirical evidence tells us that. However, now that that dwelling prices are obviously falling, people feel poorer. They're likely to spend less going forward, and that's going to create a huge drain on household consumption. Tim, can we skip across the next one?
Yeah, sure.
So what I put here, I've done a chart showing the correlation between retail sales and dwelling prices, and it goes back several decades. And anyone who's watching this live can see that there's actually a pretty pretty decent correlation. It's not perfect. And what it shows is over the past year or so, retail sales actually held up quite well, despite the fact that dwelling prices have fallen extremely heavily. But but as you can see from as people can see from the chart, in the last few months, retail sales have fallen. They fell quite heavily in December.
This is trend, of course.
Yeah, trend. That's right. Yeah,
seasonally adjusted, they dropped very sharply.
That's right. Retail sales fell 0.4% December. So, and the annual pace also fell. But just looking at this chart, if you pair dwelling prices versus retail sales, it looks like retail sales versus dwelling prices, looks like retail sales will fall. And there's another reason. If we skip to the next chart. What this shows, that Australia's household saving rate has fallen to the lowest level in the post global financial crisis era. And basically the reason why household consumption has held up quite well and retail sales have gone stronger than you'd think with dwelling prices falling is because households have been drawing down on their savings. And this is particularly important because we're in a situation at the moment where real household incomes are actually falling. The ANU put out research today saying that they've fallen about 5% over the past couple of years. We know from the national accounts that real average compensation per employee has been falling, real household disposable income has been falling. So what it means is that other things equal, to keep household consumption at the same level of growth, you actually need to draw down your savings, and that's what we've had in Australia. But obviously this is an unsustainable situation. So households can't keep drawing down the savings forever just to maintain consumption. So unless we have a pickup in wages, consumption's necessarily will fall as household savings rates stabilise or rise, as we think is likely.
And so, of course, the savings rate always runs in a near perfect inverse correlation to dwelling prices. So as they come off, this will rise.
That's right. Yeah. So with the falling housing market, it's only a matter of time before the household saving rate rises, which means that you're going to be less spending in the absence of income growth. So we've got a pretty bearish outlook for household consumption in the period ahead. And again, that's 57% of final demand. So it's it doesn't paint a rosy picture.
Some support from mass immigration?
Yeah, at the aggregate level, sure. We've got population growth growing up still at 1.6%, so that keeps the aggregate economy chugging along as it always does. Mm-hmm. But it's the per capita experience, which is, we actually think it's pretty likely Australia's already in a per capita recession. It's just yet to be confirmed by the December quarter annual accounts. But at the aggregate level, we're probably still growing, but at the per person level, we're slipping backwards.
Do you see a lot of this being part of a deleveraging, or is it just purely a sort of an equity mate sort of falling, and then therefore the wealth effect falling as well? Do you think people are sort of tipping more in, or is that playing any part yet?
Well, certainly, credit growth's falling, but it's still positive. So it's really disleveraging, I guess. It's growing at a much smaller rate, but it is falling quite sharply. So
it's nearly falling in real terms.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, but it's disleveraging rather than deleveraging. But it's really semantics. It's certainly weakening.
And that's been a feature of the Australian economy for years, for the last 20 odd years, is that the debt and credit has grown much faster than wages and income, which is to most people is obviously an unsustainable situation. The question is, is there enough from the downward pressure in houses and the various things which Leith will go through now to actually make this the point of reckoning? So you do need to hit a point of reckoning where you need a reset. And the question is, is the current sort of credit slowdown enough to, and they have fallen housing prices enough to sort of snowball into to something bigger.
Okay. Yeah, sure. We'll jump into, and I apologise, I think the titles of these slides have been swatched about, but we've got the dwelling construction chart up here since 1985.
Yeah, so this falls into the second pillar. So obviously household consumption, which 57%, is looking dire. Dwelling investment's about 6% of the economy. And that's also looking like it's, well, it certainly has, most certainly has already peaked, and it is falling, and it will drag on public demand, on real final demand this year.
Yeah, but, and it could also, just for the, in terms of relativity, it seems as if you're saying, well, one's 10 times the size of the other, what do you care?
Mm.
In the end, the household consumption doesn't change by that much from on a year-to-year basis. It's sort of, it's a relatively smooth curve, whereas dwelling construction is quite a volatile series, and there's a lot of flow on and multiplier effects from the dwelling construction.
Mm.
So, you know, when you say it's 6%, it can be sort of, you know, 4 or 5%, and so it sort of makes a big difference in terms of the percentage of the economy that's sort of devoted to it, and the various multiplier effects.
And it does count for 9% of jobs too. Not dwelling construction, but construction in general, which obviously counts dwellings, is about 9% of employment.
Mm, okay.
I mean, there are some very bearish forecasts out there on this from the sell side, brokers and merchant banks, which I think are not to be dismissed.
Mm.
You know, most people have this falling back, this boom in construction falling back to kind of roughly where the old peaks were, around 180K new dwellings.
Just from, 30% fall.
Yeah, from this massive peak we've had up around 240, 250. But, you know, as you can see, all previous cycles have fallen far further than that.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've got quite tight credit. We've obviously got falling house prices.
Mm.
If we do start to get a snowballing effect in the economy, they could very easily shoot back to some of the previous cyclical lows.
Sort of low 100s.
Maybe not quite that low, but, you know, down around 150 or 140 seems to me possible, and in which case, you know, Damien's point where it may be only 6% of GDP, but if it falls 40%, then that's a lot of growth.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. Mm. It's the contribution, well, to the changing growth, I guess.
Yes, that's right.
So, but just just quickly, I'll just go over this chart. So what I've done here, I've put a chart of annual chart of dwelling completions, dwelling commencements, and dwelling approvals. Dwelling approvals have fallen off a cliff. It's not shown so clearly in this chart because this is an annual, the rolling annual chart. But, you know, for example, the dwelling approvals data that came out earlier this week showed that apartment approvals are down about 40% from peak.
Mm.
I think in seasonally adjusted terms, the approvals line is already back down around previous peaks.
Yeah, it's certainly falling fast. Now commencements, which is only current to the September quarter, has only fallen a bit, whereas completions are sort of about to peak.
Mm.
But what it does show, it paints a picture of the housing, of the construction falling now, and it's going to fall faster in the next year or two ahead. And in fact, the HIA has forecast 20% fall in dwelling starts over the next 3 years, and if anything, that's way too bullish.
Yeah.
So we're looking at some pretty big swings.
And we're already way past that now.
Yeah, we are. Yeah, it's looking really bad.
It's worth pointing out two things. Like the bullish side of it says, yeah, but we're pouring people into the country. You know, we've got these great growth rates, and they all need somewhere to live. So that's gonna mean this holds up. But the flip side to that is is it 5 million houses out there, households out there? Something like that.
No, it's about 9.5 million dwellings, I think.
9.5 million dwellings is right. Okay. Because so you only need a very small percentage change in the number of people per dwelling to just blow these numbers out of the water.
Mm.
Like your individual change is very quite small, and a few people who give up their holiday houses because they can't afford them anymore.
Yeah,
and,
stay at home.
And more kids stay at home because people lose jobs and move back in with their parents, and you know, there's all these things that happen, and you don't need very much of it to wipe that out. So I guess in our mind, the net household formation and demand in that is more of an economic issue than a...
It's a long-term measure, really.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, so that's one side of it. And the other point I wanted to make on the dwelling construction side is that it's quite different, this peak compared to the other ones, because a lot more of it's been apartments than yeah. in prior ones.
Yeah.
And they've got a much longer lead time. So
it's about 2 years, 2 to 2.5 years.
Yeah. So the issue is, in terms of where you usually run into problems in economies is where you get this lead lag issue where people are out rapidly building things and the demand evaporates and then you know, they have to stop and
big overhang.
Or you get this big overhang. The problem with where we are at the moment is because apartments do have a longer lead time, then that a lot of those commencements you've seen, that would never have started today. But once you're halfway through, you've got to plow through and you might have another year to run, but the house prices might be crashing and you know you're going to lose money on it.
Mm.
But it's better to lose 20% than to lose 100%. Mm. So you've got to push through and finish these off. And so, So I guess what I'm saying is this cycle, not only is it much larger than what the previous cycles you can see on that graph, the time frame is different as well in that a much greater proportion of it is apartments.
And we're actually seeing that now where, according to CoreLogic, the apartment completions, someone's actually going to hit the market, will peak this year.
Hmm.
So although construction activity is falling, a lot of these apartments with 2.5 to 3 year lead times because they're high rise are getting finished this year as at the wrong time as the housing market's busting.
Hmm.
And as sentiment and foreign buyers, etc., have left the building. So it's it's a bad circumstance. But all it means is the downside is going to be potentially huge.
And just a quick one on that that sort of apartment theme as well. So and you've been following this data for a lot longer than I have, but so obviously these are dwellings as in, a two-bedroom apartment counts
and,
as a dwelling,
houses, yeah.
as a five-bedroom does, in the outer suburbs. Is a bit of this sort of stratospheric rise because of it, of the apartment boom sort of juicing the numbers effectively?
Yeah, absolutely. The housing detached house construction has been pretty, it is pretty much running just above long-term averages.
Okay.
But apartments are running at twice historical averages. So pretty much most, if not all, of the uplift has been in high-rise apartments. That's been the marginal driver of the construction boom.
Yep, okay.
Which also, as Damien said, because it's not responsive to demand, it takes such a long lead time, 2 to 2.5 years.
And then it releases a lot more onto
exactly.
the market.
Yeah,
so as
all the people came in and we need all these extra dwellings, it took ages to actually manifest.
Mm.
But now that the market's crashing, it's coming online now at the worst possible time.
Mm, fascinating. All right, no problem. So we'll jump into the next pillar being public demand.
Yeah, look, I might kick this one over to Dave because Dave's been covering this survey a lot. But basically, the long and short is that infrastructure investment looks like it's going to peak this year and fall, which is another headwind. But I'll kick it over to Dave.
That's right. Now, this is only one half of public demand. One half is recurring spending. So that's, as Lee said, your health budget, mm-hmm. just paying your public servants. And
NDIS.
NDIS and that stuff is all booming and will continue to boom. But the part that...
And you say if they get a Labor government, probably going higher rather than going lower as well.
Yeah, there is a danger in it actually at the state level. On the eastern states, the Western Australia, which has had troubles, is now going to be absolutely flooded with money from iron ore, and Queensland's doing okay, but New South Wales and Victoria are going to face an enormous stamp duty hit from the housing bust, so they may be forced into a bit of austerity. So there may actually be some austerity forced upon them, but the big hit from public demand coming is in the investment side. So there's two halves, consumption and investment in public mm-hmm. demand. The investment side is your infrastructure, etc., roads, rail, new hospitals, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. And just as you can see, we had a big surge of fiscal stimulus out of the GFC, nice big grey mountain there, and then a lot of austerity after that as the mining boom kicked off, but then another kind of huge surge that we've enjoyed over the last 2 years, which is part of what we call the Botox boom. As it happens, there's a lot of convergences of completing projects and projects passing the midpoint this year. There are still lots of new projects coming on, but because so many are completing, it mm-hmm. means that the the peak in spending is upon us, and that's what drives growth. You got to, you know, even if you had a plateau here where your spending stayed really high in historical terms, as you can see from the chart, that would not add to growth. Again, it's about the rate of change. So you have to actually build more each year than you did the year before. That's the difficulty in this kind of CapEx investment driving your economy. It's the problem that China faces constantly as well, and constantly needs to ramp up debt to keep this huge mountain of construction getting to get bigger and bigger. So as you can see, this is from Deloitte, which has, you know, sort of the widely most considered authoritative survey, but I could show you half a dozen charts that show the same thing. The NBN is rolling off. That's part of this, but also like WestConnex, massive project in New South Wales passing the midpoint. There's a bunch of roads in New South Wales that are going to wind up this year or at least come on stream. And so the end result is hard to pinpoint exactly, but sometime in 2019, public investment is going to start falling and also detracting from growth. So public demand, therefore, will diminish over the year. Because consumption, you know, will still be positive, especially as Damo says with the Labor government. You'd expect that to continue strongly, if not even ramp up, but some headwinds for states. But the investment side is going to roll over. So that will slow, in net-net, that will slow the contribution of public demand to growth this year.
There is a potential that you see... you know, there's obviously a lot of talk about congestion and things like that, and an election coming up, a lot more money thrown at this. But you're probably talking 2021 before most of that money actually hits. So, like there's sort of a year worth of
planning and
yep. and bits and pieces that's right. before any of that stuff can,
it's really like get going. It's long lead time.
Yeah, that's right. And so because a lot of it will be the promises of from various sides, and so once they actually, you know, get it in and make it legislation and things like that, will take a bit longer. So I guess what I'm saying is there's a potential that mountain doesn't fall, back to the prior lows. But it's the main point is in the short term it's not going to new peaks.
No, it's not. It won't fall back. Governments will pile in definitely.
Yeah.
But it can't add to growth.
So pile in subject to, you know, if Australia goes through if there is a big downturn based on housing crashes and stuff like that, then the question will come back to usually what you see is federal governments and very much what we saw in the US, the federal government's out there trying to get money out there, and I need to start spending and I need to throw more money into the economy to get things going again. And in the meantime, your local and your state governments are pulling back because they're going, we don't have any cash, we don't have any money, we've got to cut back on all these projects. And so you sort of got a push-pull and usually you don't see, it's not that fast. Sort of last time we went through this whole thing about saying we need to have a whole bunch of shovel-ready projects so that if something happens, that they're all ready to go. You know, Leith will probably know better than me, but I don't think we do have a long list of shovel-ready projects that are all ready to go.
No.
Well, we've got most of them underway.
Yeah, that's right. So, and again, you know, this gets back to Dave's point earlier about the stamp duty bust. I mean, Victoria and New South Wales are looking at massive stamp duty declines. And they could suck easily several billion dollars each from their budgets every year, which is going to make it harder to, you know, to spend.
There is one good news story in this, which is the federal budget is now in the middle of a Titanic flood of cash, because the Aussie dollar keeps falling as domestic demand has fallen away with house prices, and of course now the RBA has buckled and will cut rates later into the year. That should persist. And, you know, sadly for the many Brazilian dead, Vale, you know, has run into all sorts of problems with iron ore supply. And coking coal is also supply constrained. So our bulk commodities are pouring money into the miners and into the federal budget. So when Labor gets in, there will be scope for them to ramp this up. That's a good news story going into 2020, 2021. But, you know, it's not on the schedule.
And do you think it's Is it a case of the of governments moving from a public sort of infrastructure sort of style demand, perhaps like tax cuts, perhaps, or something to do with maybe first home buyers and those sort of things, stimulating demand on the other side?
That sounds fantastic, taking short-term gains and putting it into long-term costs.
Governments love short-term gains.
Exactly. That sounds exactly like something we've done in the past.
That's definitely going to happen again.
So Kevin 07, we're going to have new televisions in the office?
We're definitely getting tax cuts. Labor's will be much bigger than the coalition.
Probably better targeted as well.
And much better targeted. The coalitions are all regressive and for the rich, which wouldn't do much. But Labor is all targeted below kind of 125K, and they'll be much larger because they can recycle their reforms from negative gearing and franking credits. So definitely going to see some support on that front, which might boost a bit of consumption at the margin, but the RBA made a big point about that yesterday when sort of talking up household income. But the fact is, it's not big enough to turn against the big health wealth headwind.
Okay, I've got a quick question just popped in here. You mentioned the RBA. Your thoughts on the RBA's revised GDP growth figures for this year, a next of 3.0 and 2.75 respectively, given that you think that we are already in a per capita recession?
What, deluded?
Deluded.
All right, fantastic. That's a
nice amusing,
surprisingly short answer to a question.
Well, the other thing,
question.
The other thing to consider is we haven't talked about net exports. There's two other components of GDP: net exports and inventories. Inventories you can't really call much; they're neither here nor there. But net exports is the sort of the great hope of the RBA to support GDP, because we've had this big LNG ramp up, so those volumes contribute to GDP, and that's true. That's coming. However, we've had this little coal accident over the last 3 months, where China blockaded Australian thermal coal. Then we had the BHP iron ore accident, and so net exports took a sizable hit in the December quarter, and we don't have those numbers yet, but they're going to detract from GDP. And then the coal problem in China has been resolved for thermal, but it's now rolled into coking. And what that means is lower volumes are going to be shipped out over this six-month period. So it's rolled into Q1, and so net exports are going to get pounded through Q4 and Q1, and
it's bounced back in Q1.
But the thermal's going to bounce back, but coking's gone off.
Yeah, and iron ore's.
But iron ore will, yeah. So there'll be some, and coking will come back later in the year, right? So there will be payback. Even so, like right now, the GDP is going to take quite a hit from the areas that the RBA is hoping that will support it, which is all a bit artificial because there's no kind of activity yet.
The other big thing on GDP from a from the exports of gas perspective is that these companies have got very low rates of very low tax rates. Most of them aren't paying any income tax. Most of them have these huge losses that they're still be writing off for years and years and years. And the royalties were done on the this PRRT formula, which basically doesn't give us very much. So effectively, a lot of that GDP is coming into the country and straight back out of the country. In terms of
basically, the more we export in gas, the poorer we get. Because you end up with high domestic gas prices. So it just shows you what a pathetic measure GDP has become in Australia. The gas miners in general are basically almost all foreign owned, and in the case of gas, we get nothing for it except high domestic prices.
And David's laughing not because it's funny, but more because we've just been pushing against this for so long. And to be honest, David blogs all the time about this, and to the sound of very loud crickets.
I'm the giggling lunatic in the padded cell that you can ignore on this issue, but that's what you get for telling the truth in Australia.
Gross national income's a better measure.
Honestly, just final demand. because it excludes that garbage.
So the bears in the market at the moment, UBS, Westpac, they all see growth around 2.3, 2.4, which is obviously materially below the RBA, and is low enough for unemployment to be creeping up, especially since, you know, some largish component of that will actually be net exports. So domestic demand, they're implying domestic demand will be quite weak. I think we'll be seeing numbers lower than that. So definitely think rising unemployment's on the way.
Okay. All right. Fantastic. So we'll jump across now into business investment. We've got a chart up here from business conditions components. And a precipitous fall in the last period there.
This was the RBA's other great hope for growth was business investment this year, because it had been ramping up last year. However, you know, kind of predictably, as the consumer began to buckle through the second half of last year, you know, then business starts to see falling demand, and of course they start to wind back their investment intentions, and you can see that here, trading, profitability, employment, all in a free fall in the last NAB survey. The quarterly was out today and it wasn't quite so dire because it's more of a moving average, but the reports from January on, you know, retail and, you know, some other kind of early leading indicators are worse.
Like foot traffic.
Foot traffic and stuff. They're actually worse in January than December. So, you know, like, this is a precipitous fall. You know, you would expect to see some kind of bounce back from this, but the trend is broken. The trend higher is, like, severely broken. And business investment is going to chase that lower. And if consumption goes lower, so will business investment. So,
And it comes back to, as well, the point that... In the run up to elections, we're expecting fully expecting to see a CapEx go on hold. People won't make new decisions until they find out what will the conditions be, of and which is a new federal government, and then and then resume from there. So there'll probably be a bit of a pick up post election, but we've got whatever 3-4 months.
It's a very unfortunately timed election, and if you look at business investment and elections, and that almost nearly always falls. So.
Okay.
So this is going to get worse.
Okay. All right. We'll jump into ANZ job ads. You mentioned a tick up in unemployment potentially for 2019.
Yeah. So the December labour market report was pretty good. So it showed that, you know, jobs growth still remains okay and blah, blah, blah. But it's a very backward looking report. A better forward looking indicator is the ANZ job ads, which is definitely turned the corner, and it's fallen at 3.7% year on year. So that points to higher you know, unemployment and less jobs growth in the period ahead. And this directly contradicts Phil Lowe's statements yesterday that the forward indicators are good and the labour market's going to keep strengthening, blah, blah, blah. We didn't put it in here because literally only received it about an hour ago, but Gareth Aird, the senior economist at CBA, has provided a really good chart which shows the correlation between house prices and employment. And surprise, surprise, there's a pretty strong correlation. So as house prices fall, unemployment's expected to rise. There is a strong correlation, but house prices are the leading indicator. So if you look at if you consider that historically, that also suggests that that unemployment's going to rise, and you know, you don't have to be rocket scientist to see why. Obviously, we're going to have falling household consumption, falling dwelling investment, infrastructure's peaking, business investment's probably peaking. So that paints a pretty bad picture.
Yeah, I mean, this is why we've been giving the RBA quite a lot of curry. Is it's not very wise for a central bank to allow this kind of combined accelerating downturn to spear into a bursting housing bubble.
And we've got rate rises.
Rate rises coming through the banks.
So,
I mean, it's like, what's the point in being a central bank if you're not going to try and...
And we haven't got our running total, but is it, how many months were you since we've been in our range?
Oh, I can't remember. It's so long, nobody can remember.
Yeah, so the idea there is, you know, the RBA is meant to have the inflation between that 2 and 3%, and we've been years, two and a half, three years?
Yeah.
Since we've last been in the range.
Yeah, it's been below it for God knows how long.
And it's quite a wide range that we've got, with the idea that, you know, we've actually got a lot more leeway than a lot of other central banks, and to be, you know, between 2 and 3%, but we're struggling at sort of 1.5.
Yeah, 1.5 to just below 2.
I mean, the December inflation was reasonable, but that's lagging again. The monthly inflation is down, core is at 1.4 and falling. You know, that's going to get worse as well.
And is it, in my understanding, the inflation figure often is positively impacted by the wrong things, like energy prices, and it's not so much a demand driven.
Honestly, if you took booze and durries out of it at the moment, I reckon we'd be in deflation.
Yeah,
our two favourite food groups. Come on.
Although the core inflation is like trimmed mean and weighted median, is meant to take out the outliers.
Okay.
So it just looks at knocks out the biggest and smallest movers, and just looks at the rest.
Okay.
But even so, as Damien said, that's been running below 2% for God knows how long.
Yeah.
Probably several years. I can't remember. For as long as I remember.
And it's been the point of, you know, the RBA is, we're just about to get back. We don't need to lower rates any further because we're just about to get back there. Mm. And that's been the story for 2 or 3 years now. And so at some stage, you have to sort of say, well, look, you know, if you're holding rates higher because everything's just about to be great tomorrow and tomorrow doesn't come for 2 or 3 years, it's saying, well, maybe you need to reevaluate your current position.
It's called future boom.
And so, yeah, that's right. And so there's sort of like there's a latent amount of cuts you need to see just to get back to where we should have been over the last couple of years before, you know, we start going into a further housing decline and then you need more.
And of course, to inflation, you can add wages growth. They've been saying, oh, it's coming. It's coming.
So really, the RBA is just waiting for a cyclone in the banana plantations. Is that what we're getting to here?
It's only a flesh wound.
All right, no worries. Well, we'll move now into the final piece of all of our webinars and podcasts, which is the investment implications. We've covered off on some pretty important components of the Australian, or very important components of the Australian economy. And how does this relate now through to what we do every day at Nucleus Wealth and the MB Fund?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, the big point is you need protection in your portfolio at this point. We've just had, you know, a cracking month of, I mean, a lot of volatility last year, but, you know, most markets are up sort of 4%-ish in January and another 3% or so into the start of Feb. You know, we've just had this great run in stock markets. You know, now's the time to be looking for protection in terms of those. And Australian stocks look expensive versus international comparisons. So we've had weaker earnings growth, but our prices have actually held up not too bad. And so, of any asset class, to me, that's the one you need to be avoiding. So, you know, the big places: cash, bonds, international shares. International shares, you get this benefit of the Aussie dollar falling as well.
Mm-hmm.
But the flip side is, you need to take into account the risks that are around the international economy. So I guess we're sort of mildly underweight international. We've got a lot more international than what we do Aussie. We've got some US dollars sitting there, and we're extremely overweight Aussie bonds with the view that the RBA, as we saw yesterday, starting to capitulate. But there's a lot more to go, and there's a lot more downside in terms of the interest rates we're going to need to see in Australia, which will benefit your government bonds if you're holding those. Corporate bonds, I'd be less excited about, and especially if you're some people think they've got bonds when they're owning hybrids, and the answer is you don't, and you're not getting the same exposure. So when I say bonds, I'm talking about government bonds and not the some of your corporates, which will, you know, especially if you're going to sort of default cycles and problems with the housing market, your CBA hybrids and things like that are going to be not the things you want to be owning when you're getting a housing
correction. Something goes wrong.
Yeah,
yep. Okay.
That's not an area of protection. They're more of a risk asset than most people realise.
And just quickly, obviously very topical this week, the Royal Commission's come out. We've seen a really big rebound in the banks. So, I think the market's responded quite positively to the what appears to be a bit of a damp lettuce through the RC report.
Yeah.
We've got some exposure, and a lot of clients have opted to actually step out of Aussie financials as well, which is an option when you invest with us.
Yep.
Your thoughts going forward for this year, 2019, for the banks?
Look, within our we run core portfolios, so they're designed to be low risk and all that type of thing. And so we've sort of got maximum, minimum sector overweights. Mm-hmm. So our maximums. Sector underweight is 15%, and that's what we've been carrying. We've been 15% underweight banks for as long as
so as low as we can go. Essentially.
As low as we can go, yeah. Yep. And so that's we've got that. And similar with Australian portfolios, we hold the minimum amount of Australian portfolios we can in our portfolios. In our income fund, we can hold zero, so we do hold zero. Mm-hmm. In our other funds, our growth fund, for example, you know, the minimum is 15%, and so we own 15%.
Mm.
And if you know if it goes up, we sell a bit. And every now and again, we actually have to buy a little bit just because it drops below, it underperforms and drops below our level. So, yeah, I'd be guessing steering clear of.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm sorry, on the Royal Commission, the point there was that there's two big things to consider from this perspective. One is, was it positive in terms of banks existentially being able to be vertically integrated and do they have to worry about being broken up or forced sales or things like that. Mm-hmm. And so from that perspective, there's an element of fear that sort of or risk that sort of went out, and that's what I think most of the rally was from.
Yep.
The second bigger, more important part over the next few years is will the stricter lending rules still apply?
Mm.
And the answer to that is a resounding yes. And actually even worse than that, it's actually been flipped back to a trial, which is ongoing between the Westpac and APRA at the moment. And so what that does is that puts another period of uncertainty. So if there had been sort of a line ruled off and said, hey, this type of lending was not okay, and here's the new rules, and you can go forward and all the, you know, everyone got behind it, then the banks could go, great, okay, now we can go out and do whatever we want,
mm-hmm.
or you know, conform to the new rules. The problem is he's actually put it back to a current ongoing case. And so from the bank's perspective, they still need to be very careful about what they actually go and do until they find out from this court case what is legal, what's not legal, and what is considered to be predatory lending and what isn't to be. So in the interim, I would expect that the banks would actually maintain that caution that we've seen from them basically since the Royal Commission started, where they've basically said, well, we don't want to be doing any more lending if it's going to be considered predatory.
Mm.
So let's sort of wind back and on the bank conditions.
Excuse me. The bank rebound might have a bit of life in it for a while because they're the go-to yield play in Australia. And as we say, we think that bond yields are going to fall a lot as the RBA is forced to cut. And that might give them a bit of support. But at the same time, you know, the degree of slowing we see coming in the economy is definitely going to have bad loans written all over it,
mm-hmm.
especially since it's coming out of housing and mortgages. And so you still don't want to be in banks. I mean, they're going to be fundamentally challenged on that front. And they all they have rising funding costs. They've got huge payout ratios, enormous dividends that are all going to be in jeopardy.
Mm-hmm.
And internationally, there is a horde of hedge funds who would love to short Australian banks. And they've quite frankly, they've lost a lot of money shorting Australian banks over the last 5-10 years. And there will be a point at where
they're right.
Yeah. And so it's the question is, you know, some of that was probably short covering and a bit of a short covering really, but there will be a point where that becomes an issue as well.
Tipping board will come. Okay, fantastic. All right, well, look, thanks very much, gentlemen, for some fantastic insights into 2019 in the Australian economy. We'll jump across to what we're up to next week. So next week we've got a special guest in, speaking of the Royal Commission. We've got Graham Hand. So we're going to be speaking to Graham via a telecast during the week for his thoughts. For those who don't know, he's the managing editor of Cuffy Links and has been following the Royal Commission very, very closely, actually attending it as well. Actually, there's a few shots I've seen with him in the background. Really looking forward to that for his thoughts on the impacts of the Royal Commission, how it's going to be affecting the banks and also the broader Australian economy. So that's Thursday, the 14th of February, 12:30 p.m. Australian Eastern Standard Time. And if you're interested in that one, head over to the Nicholas Wealth live webinar page and we'll be replaying that conversation and also talking about some investment implications afterwards, as we do with all our special guests. Well, that's it for now, and thanks for watching. If you like what you heard today and you'd like to hear more, head over to nucleuswealth.com/subscribe. Give us your email address, and in return, we'll send you a weekly email with new webinar topics, links for our podcasts, and other news from Nucleus Wealth. I certainly hope you've got something out of today, as I have, and we'll look forward to catching you with the next one. Cheers.